Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Welcoming to the show this morning, Trooper First Class Pedro Muniz, who's with the state police. Good morning to you, Trooper Muniz. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's do, first of all, the latest data from state police, because most news sources have looked at just Friday to Sunday. But I know Monday was no picnic in the park. So could you tell us what we're looking at this morning from the entire weekend?
Yeah, the right now, with the data we've collected, we've had 6,448 calls for service, 547 motorist assists, 615 speeding violations, 145 seatbelt violations, 451 hazardous moving violations. That's to include unsafe lane change, following too closely, moving over, et cetera. 37 DUI arrests, and we responded to 359 accidents. And out of those accidents, 35 were reported with injuries, one with serious injuries, and 10 fatalities.
Ten fatalities, yes. I'm just going to go out on a limb. Is that up from last year? I feel
that
like it is.
That is absolutely up from last year. So the last 3 years, 2021, we had one fatality. In 2020, Memorial Day weekend, we had no fatalities. That was the pandemic. And then 2019, well, the year before, was one fatality as well.
Wow.
Yes.
So what does that tell us?
There's just, there's so many factors that go into a fatal motor vehicle accident. Drinking, driving, speeding are definitely the two biggest factors that go into, that cause fatal accidents.
I'm noticing, Trooper Muniz, a lot of wrong way crashes. Now, that's not to say that they never happened before.
Right.
I want to make sure that's very clear, but I'm noticing more and more wrong way crashes on our highways. And you talk about speeding, Memorial Day weekend, that's the stats you gave are horrific, but speeding's been a problem. I feel like coming out of the pandemic, it's been a real issue on our highways. Would you agree?
Yeah, I definitely do agree. I think people, when the pandemic happened, there was less vehicles on the road, so people got used to driving faster without, with so many less vehicles. And then the restrictions lifted, more people were on the road and people continued to speed. I was with my family over the weekend, and there was a ton of cars just blowing by me. So we're definitely seeing more speeding out there.
But, it's interesting, Trooper Muniz. After the pandemic, you're right, we saw that uptick because we had so many people who were just itching to get out. And part of it was that. Part of it was, no one was really driving around. I know for myself, I worked all during the pandemic. So did first responders, people like you. So we saw it. I can vividly remember driving to work even at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is when I come to work, and seeing people going 90 on 95.
Yep.
And I'm like, there's three of us out here. Where are you going? What is happening right now? And those trends have continued on, 2 years later. And I was kind of hoping as more cars showed up, that trend would stop. But it really hasn't stopped. And I'm wondering why that is.
Yeah, I wish I had that answer. Unfortunately, people are, I don't know why motorists continue to, speed and everybody's in a rush to get everywhere.
But haven't we always been in a rush? And again, I'm not blaming you. Like that mentality of being in a rush, we've always been like that.
Right. Absolutely. I think, we're definitely always in a rush. People are always in a hurry to get everywhere. There's so many factors that can be considered on why people are speeding. So it's definitely something that is a little bit of an issue. You know, wrong way drivers, like you mentioned before, we are seeing those as well. I mean, those there's you have DUIs, drinking under the influence of alcohol or indoor drugs, is a big one. Why wrong way drivers happen. Also, elderly, you know, they tend to, if they, once they, you know, reach a certain age, it's more difficult for them to travel and drive. And it's up to us, it's up to their loved ones to, you know, just see their driving abilities now as they hit the older ages to see if they are capable of driving still.
We're chatting this morning with Trooper First Class Pedro Muniz with Connecticut State Police, and it's a follow-up to Memorial Day weekend. Connecticut, we should not be proud of these stats. They are not good. You know, 10 fatalities in a four-day period is nothing to brag about. That's up from the last 3 years combined, which is really awful. You know, we talk about speeding, Trooper Muniz. What about people who go too slow? You know, we had a listener who called about that, and he makes a good point. You know, sometimes it's just as dangerous if you have people who are going 40, 45 miles an hour, because most of the time they're distracted. They're either texting while they're driving, they're eating their lunch while they're driving, they're doing whatever the heck they're doing, but they're going too slow, which is why people are speeding around each other, which is why people are slamming on their brakes, and then there are fender benders. You know, what about people who are driving too slow?
Yeah, absolutely. There is that minimum speed limit on limited access highways, which is, you know, 45 miles an hour in most areas. So if you are going to travel at a slower rate of speed, stay in that right lane. We've definitely come across motorists that are traveling at a, you know, 50 miles an hour in the left lane. We want to keep all the, you know, just the slow traffic, keep it to the right as that's designated. The distracted driving is definitely a big one. And when we think of distracted driving, our minds quickly go to cell phones, And that is a big one, but there's so many other distracted driving issues that we've come across. I've seen people shave, put makeup on, eat. I've even seen people play instruments while driving. There's definitely a ton of different ways to be distracted while you're driving. I've seen even people
shaving
reading.
Shaving so into that's that. Reading? Yeah. No,
reading,
stop.
Yes.
Now you've got to stop it.
I'm not.
Reading?
I'm not joking. Yes.
My gosh. I'm sorry. I don't even mean to laugh. I'm sorry, because this is not a funny thing. But come on.
Right. But
come on.
You can't make it up. You want to laugh about it, because yeah, it is definitely something that that occurs. There's so many different ways that people get distracted. I mean, you know, with our teen drivers, I believe it's around 42% more likely to get into an accident when there's another teen in the vehicle with them.
Because they're talking, looking around,
they're distracted
whatever.
With friends. Yeah,
yeah,
joking around. So even having another passenger in your vehicle, you know, especially teen drivers, can affect.
Could be distracting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, makes sense. Yikes, Connecticut, we did not do good this weekend. And our troopers were so, so busy. They responded to about 5,000 calls this weekend. And we had a lot of fatalities, more than the last 3 years combined over Memorial Day weekend. And we got some real problems on the roads. I mean, and we're talking this morning, thankfully, with Trooper First Class Pedro Muniz in you know, Trooper Muniz, you and I have kind of made it super clear that, yes, Memorial Day weekend, it heightened an issue that's been here in Connecticut as of recent years, which is our highways and our roads are dangerous. I know I hear it all the time from my colleagues, who a lot of them don't live in Fairfield County. They've got to travel about 30, 40 minutes. Most of my bosses don't live anywhere near here. And they have to drive, and they're nervous. They are they've got younger kids, a lot of them, and it's just really unnerving to drive on our highways. And I'm wondering, first of all, we know that state troopers as well as state workers, we're seeing shortages in areas that we really need. Do you think that that takes a big, is that a big reason why we're seeing the highways the way that they are right now?
I don't know if that's a big reason, definitely a factor in it. I mean, we can only do so much. We can only stop so many vehicles, you know, in a day. One person can only stop so many vehicles on their shift. And I think it's definitely something that we need to be considerate of. I think motorists need, we need to, as a community, as a state, need to watch out for each other, think about each other, and realize, you know, one fatality is not good, let alone 10. And we need to just really think about each other. Is it really that important to go that fast to get to where you're going and make, and possibly not make it and make it unsafe, or not, or that other person may not make it? So we need to kind of just work together. I think this is definitely something that we can all do better at and work together more in.
So I've had a few suggestions come through from our listeners who, I have to say, True Bermudas, we have some of the best listeners in the state of Connecticut. They're very educated. They really care. And they've got some great ideas. I don't know if these are things that have been, are being discussed in Connecticut, or if there are reasons why they're not being used. But I thought I'd throw a couple at you and see what you thought of them. First of all, you know, you had mentioned that sometimes you have older drivers and it's up to kind of family or loved ones to sort of see where they're at and if they should continue to drive. What do you think about retesting people, you know, every 15 years or something like that? You know, we've had insurance agents, for example, come on this show and they're like, hey, every 5 years we have to retest to make sure we keep our license to sell. Why shouldn't drivers have to retest to make sure they are able to keep driving on the road safely?
Yeah, I mean, retesting can definitely be a an option that is definitely a viable option. That's, I would say, out of our my wheelhouse. That would be more of DMV and what they would do, and those testings would come from them. It's definitely maybe something that can help. I think we right now we just really need to watch out for each other again. Watch out for our family. We know if our, you know, grandparents or our parents, our elderly loved ones, we know their abilities, or we know that they might start having those issues while driving, and we need to just look out and really just check on them and make sure they are good.
What about retraining driving instructors? Because, again, you talk about teen drivers and how they're about 42% of them, or you said 40, there's a 42% chance, something like that, that they will get into an accident. And a lot of that is because they're distracted. Do you think it comes down to retraining our driving instructors? You know, or do you think that that's just a trend that's going to continue with that age group?
I think that that's the inexperience of being a teen driver. I think that has to play a big part. You know, you get your license early. We do have that graduated driver's license program in Connecticut here. So, you know, when you get your license at 16, you're not allowed to have any passengers right away. So, and that's the reason why.
How long is that though, Trooper? Because I remember being 16 and I hated that rule, but thank God I had that rule. Cause I'm going to be honest with you. I would have been that distracted driver. I'm still that way sometimes. In fact, that's why I'm going to be honest. My siblings sit in the back seat. Cause when my sisters get to sit in the front seat with me, I absolutely can be distracted. No one sits in the front seat with me except for my husband, because he's like a drill sergeant, but everyone else sits in the back. So how long is that time period where you cannot, as a teen driver, have someone else in the car unless they've been driving, I think, for 5 or so years? I can't remember the rule exactly.
Yeah, so you get your permit. You got to drive with an adult. Then once you do that, you can get your driver's license. And then once after that, I believe it is until the age of 18, if I'm not mistaken, that's when you can start having passengers in your vehicle.
Until you're 18, really?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow, that must have changed.
18, yeah. So yeah, it's a recent change last few years.
That's a great change. I didn't realize that.
So once you turn 18, the graduated license restrictions are lifted.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay. That's a big deal. I didn't realize that happened.
And a big part of that is because, like I said, there's so many statistics out there showing how dangerous it is for teens to drive and when they're the inexperience that they have and the distractions that can happen with having friends or just, you know, not being able to notice a dangerous situation when they're coming upon it.
And then I had one more question from a listener. With wrong way drivers, why not put I can't remember the exact term, but they're like spikes, you know, the pop the tire spikes. Why not put those on the off ramps so that when you're getting off, it wouldn't impact you? But if you are going the wrong way, it would pop your tires before you can go far enough to hurt someone.
Yeah, I think there's I know DOT is definitely looking into, you know, different ways to they're always looking into bettering our highways and making them safer. Right now, you know, they do have tons of signs out showing the wrong ways. I know in certain areas they have flashing signs as well. So, I mean, there are definitely great ideas out there that can definitely help with wrong way drivers, and I know DOT is looking into the best ways to make our highways safer and to help with wrong way drivers.
And these are things I could certainly bring up with the governor later this week when he comes on. But I'm just thinking, you know, Trooper Muniz, I don't know if you do drink. I know for myself, I'm not a huge drinker, but I certainly have drank. I can't lie and say I don't drink. I have. And I still do sometimes. But I think you and I both know that signs and flashing lights sometimes, if you were to get behind a car, I don't think it's going to do much, especially if you're saying that wrong way drivers, a lot of the times it's because they are drunk or they're high. That they're getting behind the wheel, I'm thinking, you know, we take stronger action and you stop that car, you know? I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, definitely drinking and driving is a big issue when it comes to wrong-way drivers is one of the biggest reasons. And, again, it starts with us. If we're out with friends, if we're out drinking and you know your friend is or your loved one has had a little too much to drink, you know, call a rideshare program, something like Uber or Lyft. Take the keys, take them home. If you're drinking too much, just, you know, use a rideshare program or use it to get to your location and then come so that way you don't have a car to go back in. I think we have to be more responsible with our drinking and knowing that, hey, I'm going to go out and have a good time and I'm going to go drink, do it responsibly.
Mm-hmm. Trooper First Class Pedro Muniz, thank you so much for coming on this morning. Thank you for the work that you and the Connecticut State Police do all you can to keep our roads safe. And we just got to keep chipping away at it. I appreciate you coming on.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
The gunman who attacked a school in Texas 1 week ago today was able to enter that building unobstructed. And according to Texas Rangers, he was not greeted, I should say, by an armed guard, or challenged is a better word. And the teenage attacker, it's not even clear if the school door he went through was even locked. I wanted to talk about school safety because a lot of you are curious about if our schools are safe enough for our kids, what are we doing, and has anything changed since Sandy Hook especially. So joining us this morning to talk a little bit about this is Fran Rabinowitz. She's the executive director for the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. Good morning, Fran. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, Melissa, and good morning to you.
So, Fran, I wanted to have you on because I know you also have had experience as an educational leader in Bridgeport. So in your professional opinion, what has Connecticut done? I'm going to say since Sandy Hook, because I think that's when we really saw a surge of changes for school buildings.
Well, I would say when Sandy Hook occurred, I was superintendent in Hampton at the time, and of course, it was absolutely devastating. And the following week, we brought our forces together. And did things change? Yes, they did. We looked at all kinds of safety measures for our schools, ensuring that prior to that, our doors had been locked and you had to buzz in. But we also did things with the classrooms to make sure that the classrooms were locked and could be opened only from the inside. And there were many, many other things we looked at. We had security. We added security. And that was the case. My case was not unique. We did that across the state. I remember heading up a safety team for the for Hampden, not just for the school district, but for private schools, everyone within the boundaries of Hampden, in order for us to brainstorm and know what was best in safety.
Now, Fran, the last time you came on, ironically enough, we talked about metal detectors in schools.
Yes.
Do you still think that that is a good idea, especially with what happened in Texas?
Well, I think metal detectors, listen, Melissa, I think everything that we can do to harden the schools to make them more safe
is a good idea.
Is a good idea. Mm-hmm. But I will also say to you that after Sandy Hook, that weekend, we held a vigil. Scott Jackson was the mayor of Hampden at the time. We held a vigil together for the parents. And I remember being asked, are our schools safe? And I said, they are safe. We'll make them even safer. But I need to tell you that I cannot guarantee that they are 100% safe for your children. And I don't think anybody can do that.
What do you think about resource officers? Because that's a big debate, too, whether they're effective or not being on campus.
Well, I mean, I know it's a big debate, and I've had that debate for the last couple of years. I regularly talk to Senator Murphy's office, and Senator Murphy, I think the world of him, but we are not on the same page on this, because I do believe that school resource officers are incredibly important. Mm-hmm. I had them in Hampden. I had them in Bridgeport. They were well trained. And for me, for those two districts, I saw a decrease in arrests, et cetera. But here's what I would say to you. It depends upon your outlook and how you are going to work with those SROs, how you see them, your relationship with the police department, and what you want the SROs to be.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Fran Rabinowitz this morning, the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, talking about our schools and if they're safe enough, and, you know, parents who are terrified across the country, especially after the most recent shooting in Texas 1 week ago today. So, Fran, do you think that we have become lax as a society, relaxed as a society? I shared a story last week. I didn't say which school it was because I would imagine a lot of schools have started to kind of relax a little bit. Plus, I don't want to call anybody out. But I spoke at a Bridgeport school with seniors. And when I got to the school, there was a buzz-in situation. I pressed the button and I was let in. I was never asked my name. There were no cameras. And as soon as I walked in, I was greeted by easily 30 students who were coming out of either the gym or something like that. And I thought to myself, literally in that moment, not even knowing about Texas, I thought to myself, thank God I'm not a shooter. Thank God I'm not an attacker. And that was the first thing I thought of. And then, unfortunately, and ironically enough, Texas happened. Do you believe that we have kind of gotten to a point where we feel in some ways that Sandy Hook happened, so we're not going to get targeted again? Have we thought of retraining schools on making sure that they're really using the technology in place as much as possible?
Well, I do believe, I'm sorry that happened, because I do believe that we do regular trainings in the schools.
Oh, you do?
We do fire drills. Mm-hmm. Yes, we do absolutely regular trainings on how to use every piece of the technology. And certainly, you know, I've read some articles this week where, you know, the school's secretary is pivotal in this, because she is normally the one who does the buzzing or lets someone into the school. And I, yes, the trainings are regular, but, you know, Uvalde was certainly another reminder that we have to be vigilant each and every day. But let me also say to you, Melissa, until we get these guns off the streets, we're going to have these things happen because we can be as vigilant as we can be. But, you know, somewhere someone's going to leave a door open, or someone's going to forget to ask who it is. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, until we do that and address the mental health concerns, we're going to have these issues.
Fran Rabinowitz is here. She is the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. And Fran, the last thing you said, I can't really disagree with you. I think as long as we have semi-automatic weapons available to the public, I think as long as we allow for background checks to only be done in some states, not all, very easy things. Safe storage is not something you'll find in every single state. Unfortunately, I think this will continue to happen. But I'm curious, from your perspective as an educator, you've been in this industry for such a long time, how do you think we press on is the best way to put it? You know, I think when you're realistic the way that you're being, which is that until you see major change happen, this is going to continue. Like, how do you press on? How do you encourage other educators to press on?
You know, Melissa, that is such a great that's such a great question. Nobody asks that question. And I think that the only way that we get people to our wonderful teachers and administrators to press on is to talk to them about what would make them feel as safe as they possibly could, and, you know, provide those safety measures for them. You know, this is not a job. It's a calling. It's a mission. It's a profession. And our people love our work. And so I think that calling them together and letting them know that they are, again and again and again, very important people in children's lives and have a tremendous influence makes all the difference in the world. Because just like we can't tell the parents you're 100% safe, we can't tell teachers that either. Mm-hmm. But teachers are loving people, and they want to do good things for kids. And I think bringing them together and telling them that, and I might say having the community and our nation tell them that, how important their jobs are, is paramount in this.
And I know there's the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., who would love to see more teachers armed. From your educated perspective, have you heard any teachers in Connecticut say, yes, I'd feel safer? I'm not even talking about if it's a good idea or not, because I don't want to dive into politics. But have you ever been told by a teacher, I would feel safer if I could be licensed, like if I'm licensed to carry, to bring my gun into school?
Never.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Again, not to put
they're
a
just not. They're, yeah. We're not made that way.
Teachers aren't made that way, you're saying?
Yeah, you know, that's not what we believe that, you know, that's not what we want to do. Obviously, we would do whatever we had to do to protect our kids, but we can do better than arming teachers. We can do better. We can get these semi-automatics off the streets, and we can do a better job with mental health care.
Mm-hmm. And even I was curious what you thought of this. I know, again, I've talked about universal background checks. I've never understood why that's so hard to pass. I really don't get it. But, you know, when you do look at, for example, what happened in Texas, and we've seen that with even other cases of mass shootings, even having a universal background check would not have changed those attackers getting guns a lot of times, because it doesn't include things like mental health evaluations, or if they meet with guidance counselors, or if they have psychiatrists in their lives, or whatever it may be, or that they struggle with depression, that they're on antidepressants, whatever it may be. When we say universal background checks, I know you had mentioned we need to improve addressing mental health. Do you think that that's something that should also be included? People having that included for, like, when you if you were to have a background check, to also have like a mental health evaluation before you get to purchase a gun?
Yes, I think it gets yes, I do. But I think it gets trickier on how you do that.
Mm.
But, you know, I would certainly leave that to the experts in the area. But I would do anything we could do to restrict the sale of guns.
Okay. Fran Rabinowitz, Executive Director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, we appreciate you coming on and sharing all of this with us this morning. Thank you.
You're welcome, Melissa. Take care.
Thank you. You too. Always love having Fran on the show here on WICC. Here's a direct quote from Governor Ned Lamont in April of this year. Childhood lead poisoning has catastrophic impacts on health and development, including irreversible learning and developmental abilities. In particular, again, Governor Lamont saying, this problem has most deeply impacted minority families and those who live in disadvantaged communities. Now, again, he brought attention to this only a couple of months ago, and I wanted to talk a little bit about it this morning on the show. Joining me for that is Dr. Andrew Wong, a primary care physician with Hartford Healthcare Medical Group in Westport. Good morning, Dr. Wong. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Well, thank you.
So glad to have you here this morning. So talk a little bit about this. How significant is lead poisoning, and how do kids even get that? How does that even happen?
Yes. Yeah, this is a very important topic. Environmental toxins, environmental factors, especially lead, I consider to be a hidden epidemic, which makes it particularly hard to deal with because it's not like an infection where you see a sudden change in a human being or loved one. In this case, it's a much more subtle change, things like neurodevelopmental delays, which, if undiagnosed, can perhaps lead to conditions like ADD, autism-like conditions. So this is a really sort of epidemic that's hidden but very important. And to give an example, in 2020, there were 3,000 children identified with toxic levels of lead in their blood, and only 120 investigations took place. So there's a real gap between this environmental exposure or hazard of lead and being able to be proactive and preventing that from happening. To put into perspective, over the last 10 years, there's been 20,000 cases, or about 2,000 children per year, with toxic levels of lead in their blood. And 20,000 is about two times more the number of children that were affected by the Flint water crisis. So this is a real epidemic that I think, hats off to our governor, hats off to the state legislature to kind of recognizing that this is a real public health issue.
Okay, so Dr. Wong, there was an awful lot that you just said there that was very important, so I want to unpack some of it. First of all, a hidden epidemic? That's an intense phrase to use for lead poisoning.
Yes, yeah, and I don't think I'm exaggerating that term, because there's, you know, again, 1,000 to 2,000 children per year that are diagnosed with toxic levels of lead. This is measured as 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. And the CDC and the American Association of Pediatrics have stated that even with a level of 5 micrograms of lead in the blood, it can lead to irreversible neurodevelopmental delays. And as a parent of a special needs child, I'm very sensitive to that. What are all the factors that are causing this real explosion of diagnoses of autism and ADD, and in adults, autoimmune disorders, perhaps even Alzheimer's dementia in the elderly? What are all the factors that are causing these illnesses to rise up in proportion to our population. And you have to wonder about environmental factors like lead. And Connecticut in particular is it's a very hard epidemic to treat because it's not like a main water supply that has the lead that's easier to detect by the Department of Health. But it's really more houses that have been built prior to the 1970s. And, of course, in Connecticut, there's a lot of houses and that were built at the turn of the century and perhaps paint that's falling off with lead in it. Lead was only removed from paint in the 1970s, and so there's many houses in downtown areas in the cities like Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, where there's still lead paint falling onto the floor.
Yeah, so that's I'm glad that you brought that up. We're talking to Dr. Wong this morning about lead poisoning. That's what I was wondering. Is it coming from mostly, you're saying, paint from older homes, not drinking water?
Exactly. So that makes it harder to treat because it's really on a local level. Multifamily houses, for example, in downtown areas where the houses may not necessarily have the upkeep that they need, and kids play outside by the water hoses, especially in the warm weather. They're drinking the water from the hoses, and there's going to be sometimes paint chips that are nearby that kids can consume, also in the soil. And so what this act, what the House Bill 5045 does is that it really lowers the threshold for detecting lead in the blood. Another hidden cost of the COVID epidemic is that many people aren't seeing their doctors. And so normally the pediatrician, who's the one who tests for lead in the blood, isn't seeing as many kids during the pandemic. And so sometimes this can go undiagnosed. But really the essence of House Bill 5045 is that we're being much more proactive. So previously, if a child had lead levels that were 10 micrograms or less, so 5 to 10 micrograms in the blood, the pediatrician would give the parent some literature saying, oh, this is what you should look out for. Make sure that the areas around the house don't have old paint, and you should let your landlord know that the paint should be dealt with. And kind of putting that responsibility on the parent's hands was not a very effective method. And so we're seeing a lot of adverse effects of that. So what we're doing now is that even at a level of 5 micrograms in the blood, that will automatically trigger an inspector from the state to come and really find where that lead exposure is happening. And I think this is going to be a really great thing. We're going to probably find out that there's a lot more environmental exposure that we have, and particularly for young kids in the cities that we weren't previously aware of.
Mm-hmm. Lead poisoning is a serious thing. In fact, Dr. Andrew Wong, who's here with us this morning, a primary care physician with Hartford Healthcare Medical Group in Westport, is calling it a hidden epidemic. It's a really serious thing. So a couple more questions for you, Dr. Wong. You had said earlier in this interview that you said around 3,000 kids either last year or on average in the U.S., I'm just confirming. Is that what you were saying?
Oh, so in Connecticut, believe it or not. So over the last 10 years, about 20,000 cases of lead poisoning in kids. And again, that's about twice as many kids that were affected in Flint. So in Flint, Michigan, about 10,000 kids were affected by the lead in the water there. In Connecticut, 20,000 kids over the last 10 years.
Wow. Okay. And then you were saying, though, you made a statistic that I thought was really shocking. You said something about 3,000 kids and only 100 were investigated. What was that fact again?
That's right. So in 2020, 3,000 children were identified as having potentially toxic levels of lead in their blood, which is 5 micrograms or more lead per deciliter of blood. And that's the way that we measure lead toxicity. That there were about 3,000 cases that were detected in blood tests, but only about 120 investigations actually took place, meaning that an inspector from the state would come by and really find where that source of lead was.
I was just going to say, so what does that mean? So there were, I mean, the majority of those cases, what they did, the parents just went home and were like, this stinks, this is what it is? I mean, how does that happen that
yeah,
they weren't
right.
investigated?
So, Yeah, it was really kind of, the burden was really put on the parents, which I don't think was a good solution, obviously,
right.
Because what are the parents going to do?
Well, what
get
do you
a
know about lead poisoning?
Template?
What do most people know about lead poisoning? I mean, you know, I've heard about the house thing for a long time. I got to be honest.
Yes.
I've worked in news for over a decade. I've heard about the house paint thing. And to me, when you move into a new home, you know, they do the inspections. They
yes.
check to see about your paint. They check to see what age your house is. They check to see what your levels are in the ground and all of that and your exposure and so on and so forth. But, you know, if you find out that from your pediatrician that your kid has lead in their blood, levels that are really troubling, like, what does that even mean? Like, I wouldn't even know what to say as a parent. I wouldn't know what to say or to do. So I don't fully fault parents only because it's like, what do you do with that? Once they're like, hey, sorry, this is what it is. Good luck.
Yeah,
you know,
I think
what do you do?
And that's why I call it a hidden epidemic, because it's not like an infectious illness like the flu where you say, oh, my kid has a fever, they're sick, they're coughing. You don't really see the effects of the lead until potentially years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, I think we really have to thank our environmental factors, toxins, perhaps reasons why we're seeing really an explosion in the amount of autism that we see in children, ADD, even food sensitivities. Could it be related to certain exposures that we have in industrialized society?
Interesting.
And then, like you said, when you buy a house, you have a inspection and they look around at the house and they check for lead to see if things are safe. But if you rent,
Yes,
a lot of the cities where and this is a real social economic issue,
yeah.
is that, you know, another cause of social economic gap, that if you're renting and you just have to trust that
your landlord
is doing what they're doing. And sometimes they don't even know. Maybe they have multiple properties.
Right.
Dwellings, and they don't realize that the paint around where the kids play or where the water faucet is outside when they play in the hot weather
And inspections are expensive. I know they're expensive. It's not like it's cheap. So, you know, if you can cut corners, or even if you yourself buy a home and you're like, you know what, I just put a pretty penny down and I got to take out a mortgage, and the last thing I want to do is spend money unnecessarily. Like, I'm going to go with whatever the property owner before said, and you go with it. I'm curious, Dr. Wong, can the average person request a lead test for their kids, or even as an adult? You know, when you bring up Alzheimer's, I would think, like, you know, hey, even as a 31-year-old right now, I may want a lead test just to say, hey, like, have I been exposed and could I be at risk of something like that?
That's actually a very good idea that you mentioned it. I'll have patients who come in and we do their physical labs. And it's probably not a bad idea that we think outside the box. And if there are symptoms that we're concerned about, my memory is off, or I just don't have the energy like I normally do, even neuropathy, symptoms of numbness in the fingertips or the toes, it wouldn't be a bad idea to do what we call a heavy metal panel, where we check for mercury toxicity. And we see that in people who eat a lot of fish, right? So
yeah, sure.
Fish is really healthy for you. Especially wild-caught fish, but too much wild-caught fish can actually cause higher levels of lead in the blood. I've also seen mercury, sometimes arsenic, so it's pretty rare, but sometimes we see it.
Mm-hmm. And last question for you, Dr. Wong, is there a way to reverse it? If you have lead poisoning or high levels in your blood, can you reverse it?
So if you have lead that's a relatively recent exposure. Yes, you would go to the emergency room, and you can get something called EDTA. It's a buffer that basically neutralizes the lead in the blood, and that will help you excrete it. But once the lead has been bound to your brain and your nerves, you can't do anything about it. It becomes a chronic condition. And so that's why early detection is really key. So once we see those low levels of lead in the blood with this House Bill 5045, now the state has the resources to send an inspector there and find the source of it and stop it right away, so that it's not a continuous ongoing process.
And is that covered by the state, or is that something like if I requested it for our home, because I know that the paint is during that time where it could be lead exposure to our children? You know, is that something I'd have to pay for, or the state is covering it?
I believe it's triggered by a blood test.
Okay, if you have an individual. I gotcha.
And so once that happens, the state does have a lot of flexibility that I know that they can actually reimburse landlords, for example, for repainting the house.
Gotcha.
To get rid of the lead on that level. So it would probably be possible that if someone in the house did have a higher level of lead, that the state might actually be able to provide resources to let you inspect for the lead. They would send an inspector to find lead, and if it's there, the state would probably be able to give you resources to repaint the house. So you got to start with the blood test, though, and you got to see your doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Wong, really interesting information, very alarming statistics, and something to really think about, and certainly applaud that the governor is aware of it and he wants to address it. Thank you so much.
Yes, 100%. Thank you, Melissa.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. That's Dr. Andrew Wong here on WICC.